You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
That's right, you are tuned into The Wire for Monday, the 16th of January. News is back this week, so if you've been listening today, you would have noticed. News is back at BFM, which is pretty great. This is the first Wire of 2017, which is pretty exciting. I'm your host, Hannah Ross, and I'm joined by producer Martha Lees.
Hello, hello.
How are you feeling, Martha?
I'm feeling great. I'm feeling very excited to be back.
Yeah, it is exciting to be back. But then you're going off soon as well.
Yeah, so back, but then gone. So yeah, I kind of
feeling fleeting
sad.
Moment.
This is my last Wire ever.
Martha's last Wire ever. It was lovely to have you here, though. Anyway, though, on the show today, there's a new agreement between NZ and China, and they've introduced a joint electronic verification system, which gives New Zealand a big kind of advantage in customs and exports and things like that. So I talked to Nikki Wagner about customs and the positive advantages that we have gained from this agreement. I also talked to Jason Money, who is from the Tauranga Hospital, as they've opened a new cardiology centre which will provide care close to home and a one-stop shop for heart patients. And they're open today and they're taking their first patient today, which is pretty exciting. And we'll also have our weekly chat with the Green Party, and we have co-leader James Shaw on the show today.
And then we'll be talking to the executive director of Oxfam about a report that's going to be released later today about wealth disparities in New Zealand. And finally, we're going to be talking to Federated Mountain Club's Vice President Jan Finlayson about the increased popularity of the Great Walks.
So yeah, it'll be a pretty cool show today. Hopefully you will all enjoy it. If you don't want to get in touch, please text in 5395 or give us a call on 309-3879. It's always nice to hear from people, so call in, text in, whatever.
Wire. Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
So to start off today, a new trade agreement between China and NZ will be giving Kiwi exporters an advantage. The agreement launches a new joint data sharing system between the two customs, improving the efficiency of exporting. I spoke to Customs Minister Nikki Wagner about the agreement and the advantages New Zealand can gain from it.
It's all about managing paperwork into China. As you know, we have a free trade agreement with China, and therefore it's important that our paperwork is absolutely accurate. And so what we've done is we've set up an electronic verification system so that documents that are lodged in New Zealand can be verified in China instantly.
And how does this kind of verification system work?
Basically, they upload the documents from New Zealand, and then they are checked off. Everybody knows that they're correct, and then anybody can look at those documents and make sure that as the goods come across the border or at any time during the process to get to the border, they are verified.
And so what will this mean for Chinese NZ exports between there?
Well, it's all about simplifying the system, making it quicker, and stopping glitches. We've had times in the past that the paperwork has been hard to pass through. For example, we had a case a couple of years ago where the documentation was printed on a different setting on the printer. You know how you have different settings and sometimes it comes out big and sometimes it comes out small? Well, it was printed on a different setting and so it looked different. So when it got to China, the Chinese officials, who are perhaps English is not their first language, thought there's something fishy about this, and so they held up the goods coming through. So it made the process much more complicated, had to be renegotiated. We had to guarantee that, yes, the documentation was the same, and all it was to doing was the fact that it was printed differently.
Right, so this is all about just simplifying it and making things a bit easier, I guess.
And speed is really important, particularly if we're sending in perishable goods, perhaps crayfish or fruit or something like that, but also in terms of anything that sits on the wharves for a length of time to be cleared, it costs our people money. So if we can make it simpler and faster, it's going to make a significant difference for New Zealanders.
And it's been said that this will give Kiwi exporters a competitive advantage. How is this, though?
Well, we've already got a competitive advantage to the extent that we have a free trade agreement. But, of course, a lot of other people would like to have the same kind of tariff arrangements that we've got. So we're always open to people putting dodgy paperwork in. Well, this will mean that ours is absolutely accurate, and they'll know if it comes from New Zealand, it is assured.
And will China have the same kind of competitive advantage?
Well, yes, it works both ways. So their documentation will be a way to check that their documentation is accurate as well.
And so the advantage is that we have this kind of advantage where we can do it more easier and it's more simpler. Is that kind of the only advantage?
That's a pretty big advantage, actually. Yeah. We can say it very easily, more quickly and more simply. But if you think about it, if you are clearing goods at the border and you can do it in half the time, quarter of the time, and if you can guarantee that you don't have to get into an argument or a debate or find other documents to prove the first ones, it makes a significant difference.
Is there any kind of disadvantages, though?
No.
None at all?
None at all. No, I don't think so. It also links up. We've had this free trade agreement. It's working very well for New Zealand. And this just reinforces it and makes sure that everything is, that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. So there's no problem about anything perhaps being a bit dodgy around it. Always the problem with an FTA is that we have an advantage over other people. So other people are always trying to get into our coattails. So this way, it means that we know it comes from New Zealand, the documentation is right. Jointly, New Zealand and China have checked it off.
And how did this kind of agreement between NZ and China happen?
Well, we've been working very closely with the Chinese customs ever since the FTA. In fact, before the FTA, whenever we do a free trade agreement, customs is working border to border with the country that's going to have a free trade agreement with us. So we worked with them before the free trade agreement, all through the negotiations, and then afterwards. And what we found was that our certificates of origin were a bit of a weak spot. They were holding things up. They had a little bit of, because of the printing issues, just things that made life a bit complicated. So if we could clarify that, then it would be better all around. And so that's what led to the setting up of the project. It's been a detailed project. We've worked on it for a couple of years now, and it is a software project, basically. You upload the documentation in New Zealand, and they tick it off here and in China.
And I read somewhere that it is NZ has made this agreement with China, and it's the only out of two countries.
Yes, the only other country that has a similar agreement like that is Korea.
Why?
They have a joint agreement with China as well.
Why do you think other people haven't kind of gone onto this and made these agreements as well?
Because, believe it or not, New Zealand is a leader in this area. We were the first free trade agreement. Therefore, we're very much up there with the opportunity to develop a joint e-verification system. And New Zealand's, in terms of our border control and our border systems and our border processes, sits way up in the top of the world. In fact, they say that we are fifth in the world in terms of ease of exporting across the border and sixth in the world in terms of processing people at the border. Now, when you consider that we have all our biosecurity risks rolled into that, and a lot of countries don't worry about biosecurity at all, that's an incredibly amazing feat to be so successful, so quick and so efficient at the border.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
And that was Customs Minister Nikki Wagner.
Next up, Oxfam will release a report later today that exposes extreme wealth disparities in New Zealand. The report shows that 1% of New Zealanders own 20% of the country's total wealth, and that the number of wealthy New Zealanders who are worth more than $50 million also grew by 20% in the past year. The executive director of Oxfam, Rachel Lemassurier, spoke to me this morning, and I started by asking about the main findings of the report.
Oxfam is releasing today an annual report that we release around the World Economic Forum every year that has found even larger gaps between the extremely wealthy around the world and the extremely poor. And this is a really serious concern, and it has some New Zealand relevance as well. I think what's really clear in this report that is being released today is that there is a range of reasons as to why this gap is getting bigger. But what we have been seeing really since over the last 10, 15 years is that those with wealth are getting wealthier at an exponential rate. We're seeing the numbers of billionaires, and only 2 years ago we announced that the number of billionaires who owned half of the world's, equivalent of half of the world's wealth, were only 82. Now we're looking at those numbers looking more like only eight.
Can you think of any reasons for these results and why the gap between the wealthy and the poor is growing larger?
So there's a couple of reasons that Oxfam is putting forward as to the reason for this growing inequality between incredibly poor and incredibly rich. I mean, firstly, is that corporations really are working for those at the top. The world's 10 biggest corporations have revenue greater than half of that of the government revenue of 180 countries combined. So we're really looking at businesses and multinationals that are bigger than that earn more money than our GDP. They're huge. They have the ability to influence government policy, particularly on corporate tax, but also on tax credits and tax incentives. So there is a significant incentive for these corporations to encourage the governments to be light on fair tax. Secondly, we've seen also that those very companies and businesses have a tendency to squeeze the workers and reduce their what should be a decent wage, barely down to a minimum wage, to maximise their profits so that they can pay their shareholders. And we've seen some really extraordinary changes around the world in a relatively short time with the amount of profit being paid over to shareholders. Thirdly, is basically just tax avoidance. It may be that such in New Zealand, we have a relatively good tax system, but we're not actually investing in helping Inland Revenue collect that tax. Similarly, we're also at risk of those loopholes enabling the very wealthy to avoid tax. And I think one of the biggest ones that we've been able to identify is in New Zealand. We've got from the Inland Revenue's high wealth individuals unit's own data that over a third of the 252 extremely wealthy, they declared income of less than $70,000 per year in 2015. That $70,000 is actually the point at which the higher tax rate kicks in. So it's not surprising that the $70,000 is what that third are declaring. But is that fair? And we are clear globally and in New Zealand that that's not helpful in respect to managing that inequality gap.
In an interview last year, John Key stated that a quarter of a million jobs have been created in the past 2 or 3 years, and that 25% gross wage increase has occurred since the National Party came into power 8 years ago. So does the report being released this afternoon paint a bit of a different picture to this positive depiction from the National Party?
It absolutely does, and the National Government is not alone in trying to focus on income inequality, which is exactly what that data is. What Oxfam is talking about is wealth inequality, and wealth inequality has a significant impact on the medium to short, long-term needs that we have in society, whether that's about health, whether that's about education, whether it's about being able to maintain your home, maintain your car. That's what wealth is about. It's what you have in the bank. What you can with that those income increases can be wiped out by debt. They can be wiped out by mortgage. They can be wiped out by loans. So what we're looking at is wealth, and it's net wealth. You know, once you've taken all the debt away. So whilst we appreciate that the National Government wishes to draw our attention to the income inequality and how that hasn't grown in the same way, the bottom line is, what have you got to live on, and how much have you got to be able to help you manage life's ups and downs?
And lastly, what do you think the government needs to do to address these issues?
Yeah, Oxfam is relatively simple, and I think many New Zealanders would agree with us that to help reduce this gap, we're not saying inequality can be taken away or per se, nor are we about bashing the rich. What we are saying is that governments can work to ensure workers are paid a decent wage, that they too can benefit a little bit from really successful companies, and that decent wage enables them to build a little bit of wealth for them as well. The governments can put a stop to tax avoidance and really improve and increase the tax collection rates. And then lastly, ensure that also that economies work for women, because disproportionately there are many more women in the incredibly poor groups and conversely, not as many women in those billionaire numbers.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Yeah, so that was Rachel Lemassurier, the executive director of Oxfam New Zealand.
And now it is time for our weekly Greens chat with the Green Party. And today we have co-leader James Shaw on the show. How are you, James?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's good. Happy
gorgeous sunny day.
Yes, it is a nice day, isn't it, today? Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, everything. This is the first show back for us at BFM, so it's the first time to have the Green Party back on the show for the new year.
It's good to be back.
To start, kind of start off, we wanted to talk about the Mount Albert by-election and the fact that Julianne Jinta has been selected to run. So she's been selected to run, but she's already kind of conceded defeat against Labour Party. So why has she been selected to run in the first place?
Well, look, I don't think she's conceded defeat. I think she said that it was pretty obvious that she was the underdog and that Jacinda was the hot favourite. But, you know, she's going to get into the by-election in order to show the people of Mount Albert that there is an alternative to the current government, to put forward the kind of green ideas for how we can run the economy, you know, create jobs, build a more inclusive and a greener society and so on. And I think that we should take every opportunity where it's practical for us to do that.
Do you think that, though, it's kind of a waste of resources for campaigning for her if she's already kind of said that Labour is the favour?
Well, it's not. I think that's more a statement of the obvious, right? That there are usually in any electorate anywhere, whether it's a by-election or a general election, there's usually someone who is you know probably has a better chance than others. But that's not to say that you don't run, right? Or that you just throw up your hands in defeat. And there are people all over the country who want to give their vote to a Green candidate and to the Green Party. And so this was a real opportunity for us to put our best foot forward.
How does this go, though? Because there is this partnership between the Green Party and the Labour Party. So doesn't this kind of go against the partnership, or does it? What does this mean, the
no,
Labour Party and the Green Party?
Yeah, look, it's unusual, but it's actually a great opportunity to show what that partnership can look like. Jacinda and Julianne, have got a really good relationship. They've worked pretty closely to each other. This is actually an opportunity for us to show what that partnership can look like in practice. And the good news is for the people of Mount Albert that whether they vote for Julianne or if they vote for Jacinda, they'll get a progressive, strong, competent MP in their local electorate.
And was there any reason that there was no one selected to run for the Mount Roskill by-election?
Yeah, so we took a view with Mount Roskill that there was a risk, a reasonably high risk. It turns out that, it didn't go this way, but we thought at the outset that there was a reasonably high risk that if we stood, it could split the progressive vote in a way that would enable National to win the seat. And if National had won the seat, that would change the balance of power in Parliament, and it would enable the National government to push ahead with quite aggressive and environmentally destructive Resource Management Act reforms and so on. And we thought that that risk was too great. We would have preferred to have stood in that by-election, but we did think that there was just too great a risk of National winning. Now, as it turned out, National lost badly in that. But you don't necessarily know that's what's going to happen in advance.
So now in this Mount Albert by-election, you don't think there's any risk of National winning?
Well, National aren't standing a candidate, so there is precisely zero risk of them winning the seat.
So therefore there's the Labour and the Greens, they might as well put in both?
Precisely.
Cool. No, that's very interesting. I guess, yeah, it's interesting that she's kind of said that, yes, I understand that Labour will most likely win, whereas she's still going for it and still campaigning, I guess, so.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's an election year as well, right? And so we want to take every opportunity that we can get to connect with people who either currently vote Green or who may be open to the possibility of voting Green. And by-elections are a really great way to do that. you know, like I said, I would have preferred us to have stood in Mount Roskill as well, except that there was that risk, that great risk that National could pick up the seat. And I just think that any political party really ought to take every opportunity they can to put their, their policies and ideas and their candidates forward. And Julie is one of the, most competent, strongest people that we've got. And so it's a great, great way of showcasing her as someone who will make a really competent future minister in a Labour-Green government.
And now moving on to kind of the whole, there's been a lot of stuff in the news lately about Bill English and Waitangi Day and him not being allowed to speak and then apology, and now he is allowed to speak but now he's not going to be attending. What are your kind of, what is the Green Party's thoughts on this whole issue?
Well, I think that the way that successive National Party prime ministers have treated this sort of misses the point slightly, which is that New Zealand is a bicultural nation founded on a treaty between the Crown and Iwi of New Zealand. And so Waitangi is incredibly important to us, and I don't think that you need to speak everywhere. I think that the Prime Minister should go to Waitangi on Waitangi Day, and as part of those as part of those celebrations, whether they're expected to speak or not. I think sometimes it's okay to sit and listen as well, but to show our engagement with the founding of this country.
And he said one of his comments was that he would not go, and that his decision respect to New Zealanders who wanted to be proud of their country. What are your thoughts on that kind of comment? That's,
well, my experience, particularly of younger New Zealanders, is that we are very proud of our country, and we're also very proud of this quite unique sort of constitutional story, this kind of founding history between Māori and the Crown. And so the idea that going to Waitangi somehow undermines that, I find that a bit bizarre, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I guess there has been kind of a bit of controversy with Bill English being appointed Prime Minister, and I guess it's still kind of developing, and especially since it has been the holidays, I guess there hasn't been too much of him in the media or anything, so I guess it's kind of going to progress more.
Yeah, I thought it was a really unfortunate, as a kind of the first big political story back after the new year, I thought it was an unfortunate one, and I think that he could have done a better job of sort of showing some leadership and demonstrating some commitment there.
Awesome. Thank you very much anyway for coming on the show today, James. I really appreciate that. And very
great.
Interesting.
Thanks.
Cool. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. And we'll catch you in 2 weeks' time.
Alrighty.
Thank you. See you later. And that was James Shaw, the co-leader of the Green Party. We're now going to have a break and play a track from Courtney Haight, Megan Anonymous.
I was never fooled. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Next up, the Department of Conservation has reported huge numbers of walkers using New Zealand's Great Walks this summer. Due to the strain this puts on docks' limited resources, they have said that they may consider charging a differential fee for the Great Walks. While DOC considers the increased popularity to be a positive thing, some groups of trampers aren't too happy about the number of people using the walks. Federated Mountain Club's Vice President Jan Finlayson spoke to me today, and we talked about the impact of the Great Walk's renewed popularity.
Well, you really need to go back a wee bit further and consider how we project ourselves to the rest of the world, what our tourism industry is all about. Mm-hmm. Who are we asking to come here, on what principles? FMC has been calling for a task force to decide what our tourism industry is really about, what we want from our tourism industry. That bit's really important. You know, we need to have those philosophical pillars to build a strategy around. So we will be calling on Tourism Minister Paula Bennett to establish a task force, which we would very much like to be a part of right from the start, to establish these things and to make a strategy, to build a plan. As far as the Great Walks go, that's a little bit further down the track, and we've been... we've been pretty vocal saying actually differentials aren't going to make terribly much difference. You know, it's really treating symptoms there, and I think probably treating those symptoms without a decent strategy is going to be a very difficult thing to do. So we've been opposed to the idea of differentials just because they would be so incredibly difficult to implement. You can imagine so many different ways around a differential charge as a foreigner wanting to come here and do a Great Walk, and we think that probably any sort of mechanism to allow that to happen would be very expensive. But on top of that, it would also cast a shadow over our welcoming culture, and we don't want to do that. There might be a few mechanisms that could work, such as, you know, what's been going through my head recently is perhaps a mechanical solution such as a Ministry of Education booking period prior to opening bookings that would allow our Kiwi school groups to get in, for example. There might be a few small things like that, but there again, you know, I've got to say we need to go back to the big issues and find out what our philosophy is on what we want from tourism. I think we're needing lower volume, longer stay, lower impact, quieter tourism. It doesn't have to mean less money for New Zealand, but it will mean that it will be nicer for everybody, that's us and visitors as well. You know, coming a few steps away from having established principles, a good philosophical base, I think there'll be a whole lot of quite big and small-scale solutions to issues. Tourism in New Zealand obviously needs to think about how they're projecting us. So, for example, as projecting us as a place where everybody can freedom camp in solitude is just wrong. You know, that they need to stop doing that. Another thing might be that, for example, this is a fairly small-scale thing, but DOC could stop advertising the Great Walks as places where it's always summer and pleasant, you know, because they're not cake walks and they're very frequently quite inclement. So those are examples.
And with the reports of a lot of waste and bad treatment of the walks recently, what do you think is sort of the blame for this? Is it how DOC is projecting these walks to people?
It's possibly a lack of understanding of what our backcountry is all about on the part of those people who are coming here. I wouldn't like to speculate on that, but it's the kind of thing that, you know, that's a small problem that some good messaging is going to help, I suspect.
So the director of FMC, he said in an RNZ article this morning that Kiwis are being pushed out of their own back country. Do you have any idea of what that statement really sort of means?
Well, one of the most important things that people need to understand is how severely and chronically DOC has been underfunded. So DOC just needs more money, much, much more. At present, it receives a budget of about half what we spend on type 2 diabetes. It's about two-thirds of what we spend on obesity. It really is a severe shortage, and so they need that to enable them to do the conservation work that they're meant to do by statute, and they need it to look after our backcountry and our recreation. Just bearing in mind that the Conservation Act obliges the department to look after natural and historic conservation, and it requires them to foster recreation and to allow tourism. And it's a very important hierarchy that needs to be borne in mind. And it's that basic folk conservation funding that is essential to getting those two main priorities seen to.
Is there any sentiment from FMC that New Zealanders should sort of have priority, the, like you said, extended amount of times to stay there, and maybe New Zealand kids getting to book in early? Is there any sort of sentiment that New Zealanders should get priority compared to people coming from other countries for tourism?
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, differentials will be very, very hard and very expensive to run, I suspect, and pretty unwelcoming as well. But yes, there might be some mechanisms by which we could allow Kiwi children, for example, to have some priority, and because that would be fairly easy through the Ministry of Education. This is just an idea that's popping off my head. There will probably be other mechanisms by which we could do that also. But really, we need to go back, as I said, to that fundamental place where we decide what we want from our tourism industry. Always imagining, if it stopped tomorrow, if geopolitics got us, if the Alpine Fault got us, if anything like that stopped tourism in its tracks, would we be happy with what remained? And to me, you know, if we had a few extra toilet box and car parks, that it might be unsightly, but it wouldn't be a problem. But if we have something that goes deeper into our backcountry, into the ownership and control of our backcountry, then that would be a serious thing that we would have to live with for a long time, and it would be inimical to our heritage, our backcountry heritage, our national character. We don't want that. Yet we need to have this deep discussion, spend some time doing it, and then make a strategy which runs true to our principles.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
That was Federated Mountain Club's Vice President Jan Finlayson.
And now we're going to play another track for you. This is Mick Jenkins' Drowning, featuring Bad Bad Not Good. He is going to be coming to Laneway, so make sure you go ahead and buy tickets so you can see him.
Supposed to try right, wait, that don't sound right. just wait 1 second, that don't sound right.
Downtown on my hotline, it don't bleed much. Seen songs like Tubman, Young, Stealing Morris, I ain't seen much. Just a couple motherfuckers trying to rake the culture. Tell the vultures I don't need lunch. It's like war's cold, gotta be in touch to communicate it to the people. Love heals all, best get your immunization at THC. So we smoking in here like we fumigate for the fuck boys. Too much truth in me, I don't trust niggas. I ain't preaching at you, I don't touch boys. Walk the bag and drip me like a bus boy. I don't need tips, you can see minds. Rap genius, you can read minds in between lines. Yeah, they act genius, but the way society is set up almost like they read minds. You heard alchemy, boy, I'm Magneto, they can't read minds. Niggas bark loud, talking revolution. When the waves come, they turn feline. I've been turning tricks in the coldest part of the deepest water like a sea lion. You can
we
see why.
Some drugs for the situation. Shout out to my blood, it's a situation. Won't win it through litigation. All we ask is ventilation. I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
When the real holds you down, you're supposed to try to ride. When the real holds you down, you're supposed to try to ride. That don't sound right. Just wait 1 second, that don't sound right.
Te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
And that was Mick Jenkins with Drowning featuring Bad Bad Not Good. A new cardiac catheterization laboratory has opened at Tauranga Hospital and will be taking its first patient this afternoon. The lab will provide care close to home in a one-stop shop for heart patients. I talked to clinical nurse manager from the hospital, Jason Money, about the new lab.
So in the Bay of Plenty area, Tauranga Hospital serves a population of about 230,000 total, 128,000 living in Tauranga itself. So we've had a steadily increasing group of patient population. And previously we'd offered services that usually are developed over the years with the several different departments working together. And the effectiveness of this will last as long as it doesn't harm the other department's throughput. So by having a center that's independent, like we have now, what you do is you free up those other departments to carry on with work that they need to be doing and not causing any backlog among them. So for us to be able to actively investigate our cardiac patients as an individual unit rather than having to work with liaising with different departments to get a job done. So it's like with anything else, efficiency is usually gained by having direct access to the full pathway rather than having to try and negotiate an end result among other people.
And how many kind of more services will be freed up because of this new development?
So the medical day stay, which currently provides a service to us by looking after our patients before and after, will be freed up so that it can get on with some of the important work it does, like the endoscopy, with colonoscopies being a very topical issue at the moment, with national screening, as well as the radiology department, which also hosts the procedure. Previous to today, we did all of our procedures in within the radiology department. What that'll allow them to do is free them up for more things like time to screening for cancer and a lot of the other ministerial important measurements. So they'll have a lot more ability to look after their patients directly for the procedures they need to provide.
And how long has this lab been in the works for to become open now?
We've been working on it about 18 months. So there's been a collaborative effort among many people, and a lot of hard work's gone into it, a lot of commitment by the DHB to see it through, to actually provide the resources and space to be able to say it, to give us the go-ahead and the support to get it done. It's forward-thinking, very much so a forward-thinking process going on with establishing something like this.
And where is the funding come to open this up?
So the funding would have come from DHB resources. In other words, we wouldn't be taking from outside of the DHB for the funding that goes to this. So it's a matter of looking and seeing where those resources are currently used, bringing those resources centralized back into, the cardiology department rather than cardiology funding other departments to provide the service. So a centralization of that, and then also funding that is provided for the cardiac services to the Bay of Plenty patient population.
And do you think that more funding needs to be put in around New Zealand to put in more cardiology labs, or?
Well, there's two mindsets. Mindset number one is that you have many places doing work in cardiology, and the other one is that you have certain places doing work in cardiology and everyone's referred there, and they both have their advantages. I think that in a town the size or a city the size of Tauranga, that it's very becoming more and more evident that the being able to provide care closer to home benefits everyone. So I think that in that instance, for a population over a certain size, providing that care locally is better. And therefore, yes, I would say there should be more funding for that sort of thing.
And what are kind of the positive aspects that patients can take from having this kind of opened up for them?
So probably number one for most people is the availability of care close to home. To be honest, that's a huge burden on people having to travel, though we're very grateful for the tertiary centers and the service they provide, because certainly we need them to be able to establish ourselves as a regional provider. We need the people that we can refer the harder things to, the more intricate procedures to. So for us, that's Waikato, and they do a wonderful job doing that for us. But for the local population, they would always rather have something done at home if they could. If they can think that it's closer and it's safe to do, then they'll take that opportunity most times. And that's certainly what we found from our population.
And the first patient will be accepted into the new lab today, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And how do you kind of feel about this? Do you think this is a good move to have this happen, and it's an exciting thing that the first patient is going to be accepted and it's going to go well?
Yes, so my job is to make sure it does go well, so we will. We know we have the skills, we have the team put together, and we're doing a procedure that we're already quite experienced with. We're just doing it with new machines. So the objective for today is to make sure that we are carrying on just like we did on Friday in another room. We're just doing it in a new place, so we know what we're doing, and we're happy to provide that service to the population.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
And that was Clinical Nurse Manager Jason Money.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that was your Wire for January the 16th. Big thanks to everyone we heard to from today. James Shaw, Nikki Wagner, Jason Money, Jan Finlayson and Rachel Lemassier. And thanks also to the wonderful producer, Martha Lees, who is leaving to go on a big adventure. So,
Thanks, Hannah.
Yeah, you'll be missed from BFM.
I will miss BFM more, for sure.
Oh, it's very sad to see you go, but you're going to do great things. It'll be really cool.
Maybe I'll be back.
Hopefully you'll be back.
Yeah.
When you come back to NZ, BFM will always be here. Thank you also to News Director Shmina Smith. She always helps out with us, and she's great. So thank you. Hope you enjoyed the news back today, which is really cool. Make sure you listen in for more news for Drive and for the rest of the year now, because news is back. Holidays are over. Anyway, thank you very much for listening in and everything. That was Your Wire. Now we're going to play a track by Thundercat, Them Changes.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.